John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent on the morning show. The president, as he is required to do, submitted his national security plan yesterday. We'll spend the hour talking about the plan and about what it says about America and this administration's view of our place in the world. Did you take a look at the plan? Did you hear the speech? What did you think of Mr. Trump's national security plan? Is a foreign policy agenda that puts America first, in the president's words, a good one? Or does it endanger American security and interest? What advice would you give President Trump about foreign policy? Should the U.S. be prioritizing military might over diplomatic activities? Is the president right to push for a greater emphasis on military funding and cuts to the State Department budget? What do you think about all of this? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org. Ideas at WPR.org is the email address. You can post your comments or questions on the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at WPR Mornings. My guest is Jordan Tama, an associate professor of international relations at the American University School of International Service. He's also a research fellow at the Center for Congressional and Presidential Studies and co-director of the Bridging the Gap Project, which aims for informed and engaged public discourse on U.S. and global foreign policy challenges and solutions. Professor Tama, welcome to the morning show.
Thank you, John. I'm glad to be on the program.
Let's start with some basics. Every president is required by law to develop a national security document, such as the one that President Trump announced yesterday. What is the purpose of these plans, and what role do they actually play in guiding foreign policy?
Well, Congress passed a law back in the 1980s requiring the president to issue a national security strategy to help give Congress better insight into what the president's planning to do in terms of foreign policy and national security. From the perspective of Congress, if the president has to produce a document that says, this is my national security strategy, this is what I intend to do to advance U.S. interests or values, Congress can then potentially use that document to hold the president accountable, to ask questions of the president's cabinet secretaries. You said you were going to do this in the national security strategy. What have you done to advance that? Have you actually accomplished that goal, et cetera? And for the same reason, presidents aren't always enthusiastic about producing this type of document because it could be used to hold them accountable. Also, because they don't usually want to box themselves in. So in a document like this that's laying out a national security strategy, if the document is rather specific about things that the administration is planning to do, and then the administration isn't able to accomplish that, then that could make the administration look bad. Also, they may want to just preserve their flexibility for how they're going to handle issues and not, give away too much about what they're planning to do. But in this case, the Trump administration hasn't seemed to have reservations about producing it. And interestingly, President Trump wanted to make a speech himself announcing the new strategy, which was a departure from past presidents. Past presidents have issued this document, but they haven't made it into a big public event with a presidential speech. So that suggests Trump wanted to draw attention to his national security strategy.
Mm-hmm. And we're during the hour, we will be playing some clips from that speech yesterday. So how does President Trump's first national security blueprint square with his overall view of the world as he has expressed it in other policy speeches?
Well, in part, the strategy is very consistent with things that Trump has said going back to his campaign, especially the emphasis on placing America first, on restoring what he describes as lost American greatness. He talks about making America great again, as he's said as a major campaign slogan. It includes some typical Trumpian bragging. He says the U.S. under Trump is leading again on the world stage, and it's critical of past presidents for allowing the U.S. to weaken internationally. I don't think that's a correct assessment, but that's what Trump has been saying for the past couple of years. It sees military strength as the main tool for dealing with the world. The strategy talks about creating peace through strength and expresses the idea that if we have a very strong military, this will give us more influence overseas. We'll be able to accomplish what we want to accomplish, including creating peace overseas. There are some more novel aspects to it. The most, I think, notable one is compared to past Trump statements, there's more emphasis here on competition for influence with both China and Russia. Trump had been very critical of China during the presidential campaign, not so with regard to Russia. As has been widely discussed, he's been very positive in his comments about Vladimir Putin, talked a lot about wanting to cooperate more with Vladimir Putin. He has also, as president, actually praised the leader of China, Xi Jinping, quite a bit. But in this document, he's quite critical of both countries, says those two countries are acting in ways that are completely at odds with U.S. interests and values. One might guess that this reflects the influence of his advisors. So a document like this, National Security Strategy, is not just written by the president or president and, say, a speechwriter. It's written by the set of foreign policy advisors who are advising the president, and they tend to have a quite critical view of both Russia and China. And so as a result, you can get a document that is saying things a little bit differently than the president tends to say them himself. He publicly has not been critical of Russia in the way that this document is.
And NPR News has already reported a reaction from the Chinese government. Needless to say, they weren't real happy with what President Trump said yesterday and disagreed with it. Does it seem a little inconsistent, though, given how Mr. Trump has praised the Chinese, his recent trip to China, where he was welcomed with open arms and everything seemed fine? Now, all of a sudden, here we are with this national security program document that names them as one of the revisionist states. Let me ask, first of all, what does that mean to call a state a revisionist state?
Well, what it means is that the view of the administration is that China and Russia are trying to alter the international system as it's been established and operated since World War II. So going back to World War II, the United States, in the wake of that war, created a set of international institutions, the United Nations, the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, as well as security alliances, NATO especially, as well as alliances with Japan and South Korea. And all of this was designed as a way to help protect democracy, capitalism, the American and Western, political and economic way of life. And China and Russia don't necessarily buy into that whole system as much as the United States and countries in Europe and Japan do. They're not democratic. They have their own aspirations for exercising spheres of influence in their neighborhood, and they don't want the United States to have as much power in their neighborhood as it has had. And so basically the idea is they want to change the international system and move to a system where the United States is not the dominant power, where NATO and other kind of Western alliances are not as important as they are, and where China and Russia have more influence. And there is an inconsistency here between what this document says and a lot of things that Trump has done. So the document talks about China and Russia as acting contrary both to U.S. interests and U.S. values. And in values, the idea is that these are not countries that care about human rights. They're not democratic. And that's a longstanding concern of most U.S. presidents and U.S. governments, that the United States should be promoting human rights and democracy overseas and criticize other governments if they're not respecting human rights or not engaging in democratic practice. But it's very much at odds with Trump's own statements otherwise, because in other contexts, Trump has praised the leader of China, Xi Jinping, for getting his party, Congress, to sort of give him more power and sort of move China in an even more authoritarian direction. And he's basically given people the impression that he wishes he could be the leader of a system like that, where he can just amass as much power as he would like. So to say that and then criticize China for acting in ways that are contrary to U.S. values is a little inconsistent.
Well, and it has been, well, I don't want to introduce a new topic because we're almost at news time. I need to pay attention to the clock here. Professor Thomas, stand by. We're going to take a break for some news. We'll come back and we'll continue to get some analysis and have a discussion about the national security program that President Trump announced yesterday afternoon. We'll talk about the speech. It was unique. Other presidents haven't made a speech about this. They've just submitted the report. The president made a speech. What does that mean? And give us your thoughts at 800-642-1234. My guest is Jordan Thomas, Associate Professor of International Relations in the American University School of International Service. I'm John Munson. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of WPR. It's The Morning Show. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent this week. We're talking about President Trump's national security plan submitted yesterday with Jordan Thomas, Associate Professor of International Relations at the American University School of International Service. Listeners, what do you think of what President Trump had to say yesterday? And if you've taken a look at the plan, what do you think of that? By the way, there is a link to the plan on the WPR.org website. Look for the Morning Show page, and you will find it there. Is a foreign policy that puts America first, in the president's words, a good one? Or does it endanger American security and interest, in your opinion? What advice would you give the president about foreign policy? And should the United States be prioritizing military might over diplomatic activities? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. That's the number to call to join the program. You can also send an email to ideas@WPR.org, post on the Ideas Network Facebook page, or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Professor Tama, an email from Corey, who's listening in Ohio. Corey writes, "I'm a Trump supporter and think he is doing the right thing by putting America first. We simply cannot save the world unless it's at the expense of our own citizens. We need to take care of things at home before helping other nations. Does the professor think the U.S. can be a good global citizen with an America first focus? Is it enough to simply do no harm? What would that look like?"
Well, I think that pretty much everyone would agree that any U.S. president should place America first, in the sense of seeing their job primarily as advancing the interests and values of the United States. The distinction really is on how you see that, in terms of whether you see placing America first as necessitating less activity overseas to also address issues internationally, or whether you think that addressing issues internationally is a way to also advance U.S. interests and values. I tend to think the latter, and most past U.S. presidents have approached foreign policy from the latter perspective, arguing and carrying out policies that are consistent with the idea that if the United States is promoting international prosperity, helping to address international problems by working with other countries, this will also be good for the United States. It will make the United States more secure. It will make the United States more prosperous. And so I think where I most disagree with the philosophy in the Trump national security strategy is the idea that the world is a zero-sum world. That's really the idea underpinning the Trump strategy. It's a zero-sum perspective, the idea that if other countries are doing well, that means we're losing. If we're doing well, then that means we're getting ahead of other countries. It's seeing the United States only in competition with other countries. And I think the world doesn't really work that way. I think it is more of a world where when other countries are doing better, that also is good for the United States. If other countries are becoming more prosperous, this will be good for the U.S. economy. We'll be able to export more of our products overseas, for instance. If other countries are doing well, there'll be fewer security threats that affect us. And so I think working towards cooperation with other countries actually benefits us.
Well, and there's another thing in Corey's email that I just wanted to address with you, Professor. When Corey says, I think he's doing the right thing by putting America first, we simply cannot save the world unless it's at the expense of our own citizens, seems to suggest that part of putting America first means doing less on the world stage, spending less money on things overseas and putting more resources into things that are happening inside our borders. But if you take a look at the budgets that have been submitted, that's really not what's happening here, is it?
Well, the budget is important because that's really where the rubber meets the road with any foreign policy strategy, because can't accomplish much on foreign policy or other areas of policy without committing resources to it. Trump's budget for foreign policy is very heavily weighted towards military spending. So he's sought to increase military spending substantially, and that is going to happen in the budget for the coming year once Congress finalizes that. And he's proposed to cut substantially spending on other international activities, diplomacy, foreign assistance, economic assistance to other countries. He proposed to cut those areas by about one-third. Congress has pushed back on that to some extent, so Congress is going to end up approving a budget that cuts spending on diplomacy and foreign assistance by maybe about 10 or 15%, not as much as Trump wants, but still a significant cut. And I think that's a mistake, because I don't think we can accomplish all of our goals, or even many of our goals, address many of the problems in the world only through military power. I think U.S. leadership isn't just about military power. We need to have diplomacy. We need to have foreign assistance. We need to have a sustained effort to work with other countries to try to solve shared problems like climate change, to reach agreements that will reduce barriers to trade, which will help our economy. And so I think we need a strong State Department for that. And Trump's budget doesn't really support that. Our diplomats are leaving the State Department in part because they don't feel supported by the Trump administration.
All right. Well, we've got a full set of phone lines this morning, so let's start taking some calls. We'll start in Madison, where John joins us today. John, welcome to the morning show.
Hi. Well, I agree with your speaker. Trump and Tillerson are degrading the State Department, and this means that diplomacy is going to play second fiddle to military might, which is exactly what Trump said he wouldn't do in his election bid. He said he was going to put America first and not get us involved in any foreign conflicts. Regarding this current document, could you tell me what he wants to do with North Korea and Iran? And I would just add, the thing that bothers me most about all of this is we're currently involved in wars in Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, and Libya. I'm talking about extensive bombing campaigns and commando operations, as well as drone strikes. Nothing about our objectives or our progress has been at any time by Trump and his administration offered to the public. Everything is just being kept censored.
Okay, John, thanks for the call. Professor?
Sure. Well, Trump does talk quite a bit about North Korea and Iran in this document. He sees them as two of the main security threats to the United States. In general, the document, the strategy, the national security strategy, describes the world as a very dangerous place, and North Korea and Iran are kind of at the top of the list of the dangers that it describes. It's not entirely specific about what Trump is going to do to solve these security problems. Of course, there's no easy answer to them. On North Korea, Trump has been trying to put more economic pressure on North Korea, especially by trying to get the Chinese to apply more economic pressure on North Korea. That has not yet been entirely successful. I don't only blame Trump for that. I don't really blame Trump for that. The problem of getting the Chinese to cooperate on North Korea. No U.S. president has been able to get the Chinese to apply as much pressure on North Korea as we'd like. But I think Trump is too confident in the ability of the United States to use military military might effectively with regard to North Korea without there being huge, terrible consequences. A war with North Korea would really be catastrophic given their ability to kill very large numbers of people in South Korea and Japan, let alone the fact that they're now attaining the ability to reach the United States with a missile. So there's really no easy answer on North Korea. Iran, I think Trump has made a big mistake by weakening the international agreement that President Obama negotiated with Iran and other major powers who were also part of the agreement, in which Iran agreed to accept some major constraints on its nuclear program in return for the United States and the international community lifting a lot of sanctions that had been placed on Iran. This deal is not a perfect deal, but it's better than all the alternatives, the main alternatives being going to war with Iran to stop it from getting a nuclear weapon, or allowing Iran to get a nuclear weapon. Here, at least, we got some constraints put in place. There are international inspections occurring in Iran, which are important. And Trump has not entirely pulled out of this deal, but he is weakening it and wants Congress now to modify it in ways that would not be acceptable to Iran. And I think that's a big mistake, because there's really no better alternative to that kind of agreement.
All right. Thanks for that call. Let's take another call this time. We'll go to Green Bay. Saeed is on the phone with us. Saeed, good morning. Welcome to the morning show.
Yes, good morning, and thank you for taking my call. I very strongly disagree with the professor's comments on Iran. The dichotomy that he presents as the Obama Iran nuclear deal versus war is a false dichotomy. There are other options, and there were better options. The problem with the Iran deal is that it has resulted in the loss of containment of Iran. After this deal, Iran has been showing much more significant regional aggression and has opposed American interests in a variety of theaters, including Syria, Yemen, Iraq itself, and President Trump has a much more realistic understanding of the geopolitics of the Middle East, and as in his short tenure has created or tried to create coalitions between moderate Arab states and Israel. And the entire geopolitical landscape of the Middle East is changing as a result. The loss of containment of Iran as a result of the Obama deal is a very, very major mistake in American foreign policy.
Saeed, thank you for your call. Jordan Tama?
Yeah, so I agree with part of what the caller is saying. I agree with the statement that Iran is not contained in its behavior in the Middle East. Iran certainly is engaged in activities in a number of places in the Middle East, Syria, Yemen, Iraq, that are contrary to U.S. interests and what the United States is trying to achieve in the Middle East. But I don't think that's a result of the nuclear agreement that President Obama reached with Iran and other major powers. Iran was doing those things before that agreement as well. Iran's influence in the Middle East actually has been generally on the rise since the start of the Iraq War in 2003, the removal of Saddam Hussein, who was the major kind of counter to Iran for many years, helped Iran to start to expand its influence in the region. And that was a trend that was ongoing through the George W. Bush administration into the Obama administration well before that nuclear agreement was reached. So I think that would be going on regardless of the nuclear deal. The nuclear deal was not intended to solve all of the problems we have with Iran. There's no question that Iran is still doing a lot of things that are very troublesome, but it was intended to deal with the problem that's the greatest direct threat to the United States, which is the possibility of Iran obtaining nuclear weapons. And on that particular issue, I don't think there's a better alternative to that deal.
Saeed, thanks for the phone call. 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. We have some audio from President Trump's speech yesterday. Let's take a listen to a bit of that. In this cut we're going to play here, he appears to set the tone for his approach to foreign policy.
This strategy recognizes that whether we like it or not, we are engaged in a new era of competition. We accept that vigorous military, economic, and political contests are now playing out all around the world.
Jordan, this seems to speak directly to what you said earlier about the zero-sum game nature of this security document, and that is, this is, we're in a contest, and the important thing is that we win it.
That's right. So it's kind of a dark and depressing view of the world, in a sense, because a world that's entirely about competition isn't a very attractive or compelling world. I think there's a lot of truth to it, though, with regard to certain dimensions of what's going on in the world. I do think we are in competition for influence with Russia and China. Russia and China do have different worldviews, their governments in particular. They have different goals than we do. They want to have spheres of influence where they have more power than the United States does. They don't care about some core U.S. values like human rights or democratic governance. And I think there is a real competition for influence with them. And so I think the Trump administration is entirely right to call attention to that. I think where they go wrong is in seeing the whole world as only being about competition for influence. There are a lot of other challenges in the world and things going on in the world that really demand cooperation rather than competition, climate change being an example of this. The Trump administration doesn't consider climate change to be a problem worthy of a lot of attention, but you know, most scientists and most people who follow the issue think it is, and we can't address that problem through competition. You need cooperation among countries to address it. And other problems, humanitarian challenges, poverty in developing countries, international trade. This is another area, economics the administration sees from the standpoint of competition, that they are trying to resist what they consider unfair competition from other countries economically. And I think it's at least as important to promote lower barriers to trade between the United States and other countries multilaterally. And that one of the things the Trump administration did was pull out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement, which was a really important trade agreement involving the United States and a lot of other countries around the Pacific Rim. And that's, I think, the best way to deal with a lot of international problems, through broad cooperation rather than competition.
We're just about at news time. We have some more callers on the line. We'll get to those calls after our news break, but still room for you to get in on this topic before the top of the hour when we move aside for another program. 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. What were your takeaways from the president's foreign policy blueprint as announced yesterday? Have you taken a look at it? Have you seen what's in it? If you want to take a look at it, you can go to the WPR.org website. You'll find it there on the morning show page, and you can actually read it. We're talking about the president's national security program, which was announced yesterday, with Jordan Tama, associate professor of international relations in the American University School of International Service. John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to the morning show on the Ideas Network of WPR. We're talking about the Trump administration's national security policy this hour on the morning show. John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. My guest is Jordan Tama, associate professor of international relations in the American University School of international service. What do you think of the national security plan unveiled by President Trump yesterday? It's a foreign policy that puts America first. Do you think that's a good idea? Or do you think it endangers American security and interests? 800-642-1234, ideas at WPR.org. You also have the Ideas Network Facebook page at your disposal, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. So, we have callers on the line. Let's go to Rice Lake next and hear what Jim has to say. Jim, good morning. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. I appreciate your guest. I think the most dangerous time in foreign policy in the history of this country was October of 1963, the Missiles of October, that we all, many of us are old enough to remember. We had a president whose personality at the time was to de-escalate violence, to de-escalate tension. I think at these times we are living in almost comparably most dangerous times with North Korea and with a president that does not have the maturity or quite simply the stability to analyze things evenly and fairly. I'd be interested in your guest comments. Thank you.
Jim, thanks so much for your call. Jordan Tama?
Well, I think a lot of people share that concern. President Trump has shown in a lot of ways a tendency to be impulsive, to be rash, this is often seen in his tweets, where he'll say things that, you know, seem very imprudent and haven't been vetted, presumably by his advisors. And so I think there is a real worry that he could make a rash decision that could get us into a war that could be avoidable. I think the good news is that he has a lot of advisors who I think are prudent and you know, have a good understanding of the risks of getting into a war that we wouldn't really want to get into. And on North Korea, for instance, although Trump has said a lot of things that were quite provocative and inflammatory, he so far at least has refrained from doing anything that would get us into an actual war with North Korea. And one can assume that part of that is because of the influence of his advisors. And so, you know, hopefully that trend will continue.
Jim, thanks so much for your phone call. Let's go next to Janesville, where Todd joins us this morning. Todd, good morning. Thanks for joining us on the morning show.
Good morning. I was curious as to what your guest's opinion is of what happened in the United Nations yesterday or the day before. In the 14 of the 15, voting down the president's move of our embassy to Jerusalem, and how it was that Nikki Haley seemed to be wagging a finger at all of these folks.
Thanks for the call. Professor?
Well, to some extent, this isn't entirely new, the notion of the United States being at odds with a lot of other countries on issues related to Israel. There have been many UN Security Council resolutions in the past under previous presidents where the U.S. has been on the opposite side of most other countries on issues related to Israel. The United States is well known to, you know, be a strong supporter of Israel, more so than just about every other country of the world. But the President Trump has expanded the divide between the United States quite dramatically by recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. This is, I think, a serious mistake because it's giving one side in a dispute between two sides a major concession without them making any concession toward the other side. So ultimately, the status of Jerusalem is something that people involved in this issue have thought would need to be resolved as part of any final agreement between the Israelis and Palestinians in a peace process, peace negotiation. And it's logical that as part of any such peace agreement, Jerusalem would become recognized as the capital of Israel and also could be recognized as the capital of a future Palestinian state. That's something that should have been left to negotiations rather than for the United States to kind of intervene and say, okay, we're, you know, giving one side one of the major things that they want. And so I think that was a mistake.
Todd, thanks so much for your phone call. 800-642-1234. We'll go next to Franksville and hear from Dan. Dan, thanks for calling us on the morning show.
Howdy. Yeah, sounds like the propaganda was pushed out during the British Empire or the German situation there. You know, that our enemies all around us, we're insecure. You know, Eisenhower gave a speech. He sort of sugarcoated. He says the U.S. military is basically out of control. That's back in 1950. And then Kennedy got in. They told him to go take a hike. I don't think, the president really has little to say when it comes to these people at the Pentagon, stuff like that. You look at Iraq. Does the U.S. have any credibility at all? They go into Iraq, kill a million people over nothing. Then one of the richest countries, highest standard of living, Libya in Africa, they go in there, back up Al-Qaeda to take over that country, wipe out the highest standard of living in Africa. Are these really honest brokers?
Dan, thanks for your call this morning. Anything you want to respond to there, Jordan Tama?
Well, I agree with part of what the caller said, but not all of it. So certainly the military has a lot of influence over U.S. foreign policy. President Eisenhower did call attention to that and said we need to be careful to not allow what he called the military-industrial complex to have too much influence over U.S. foreign policy. But I wouldn't... the military also is not the sole driver of U.S. foreign policy by any stretch, and the military in many cases has been a force for caution and moderation in U.S. foreign policy. The military does not always take the position of wanting to get into conflicts. There have been many instances where a president or a secretary of state has been wanting to take some action overseas, and military leaders have been more cautious, saying, well, you know, this is very risky. We might want to, you know, reconsider that. And today, I think we have a situation where the Secretary of Defense, Jim Mattis, is somebody who is a very smart, prudent leader on the whole, who, if anything, would be a force for moderation and sort of sensibility in U.S. foreign policy. Not that he's not hawkish on certain issues, but he's not somebody who is rash and, you know, itching to get us into wars. On Libya, we didn't back al-Qaeda after overthrowing President Gaddafi. So what happened in Libya was there was a rebellion against Muammar Gaddafi as part of the Arab Spring. We intervened to protect rebels who were at risk of being slaughtered by President Gaddafi. This was under President Obama. In doing so, we helped the rebels overthrow Gaddafi. And afterwards, Libya became quite chaotic because a kind of stable government didn't emerge, and I think we didn't do enough to help ensure that there was a stable government afterwards. But it wasn't that we were not helping al-Qaeda. It was really more just that we didn't probably do enough to lay the foundations for a stable government to be put in place after Gaddafi left power. And as a result, militant groups like ISIS, al-Qaeda, were able to take a lot of weapons and establish areas of safe haven within Libya, more just by the absence of our involvement than anything else.
Let's take a really quick call from Peter in Madison. And Peter, we're almost out of time, so please be brief.
Sure. Well, so my question is, there's been so much provocative and antagonizing language used by the current administration that doesn't seem to be new. I mean, he was elected on the same exact platform throughout the entire campaign, but you know, why are people acting so surprised about the American First and asking why is this an inflammatory statement in general?
Well, I don't think it's a surprise. It's certainly in keeping with everything that Trump has said before. I think, as I mentioned earlier, I think the more novel and surprising element of this national security strategy is the sharp criticism of Russia in particular, in conjunction with criticism of China, although the China piece I think is less surprising. Just to give one example, the Russia section of this national security strategy report that was released yesterday says, quote, Russia interferes in the domestic political affairs of countries around the world. That was a striking statement for me to read in the Trump national security strategy, because Trump has not acknowledged that in his own comments elsewhere. He has at times, you know, rejected the idea that Russia may have interfered in our election last year. He certainly hasn't acknowledged that they did interfere in the U.S. election. And here we have that stated in a document. That, I think, points to the influence of his advisors, who probably wanted that to be in the document. And Trump either just decided to go along with it or didn't pay attention to it. But that is striking. But I think there will continue to be a contrast between what's stated on that issue in this document and what Trump says. I wouldn't expect Trump now to be going around criticizing Russia sharply. I think he'll probably continue to talk more positively about cooperating with Vladimir Putin and not acknowledging that they interfered in the election.
All right. Well, we'll keep our eyes open and be watching to see how this security plan unfolds. Jordan Thomas, thanks so much for joining me this morning.
You're very welcome. It was a pleasure to be on the program.
Jordan Thomas is Associate Professor of International Relations in the American University School of International Service. This hour was produced by Brianne Chasseau and Michelle Johnson. The Ideas Network Director, Cheryl Gasser, provided on-air production this morning. Stay tuned. Much more to come on the Ideas Network. Next hour, it's On Your Money. Peggy Olive joins me. Kevin is off this week, and we'll have some financial advice for helping keep you sane during the holidays. John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network.